Welcome back to the Technicast. I am here with my co-host, Chloe Tuck.
Hello.
And today our guest is our very own Ashley Carlson here at Technica Editorial. She's a managing editor, and a few months ago, she went to the ISMTE North American Conference, and one of the presentations she listened to was on a copyright boot camp discussing copyright and permission issues. And we wanted her to come by and talk to us a little bit about a few of the things that we discussed in the boot camp. And in particular, we wanted to talk to her about the issue of fair use and how it applies to copyright and what's in a journal publishing agreement and how that agreement varies from journal to journal. So let's just go ahead and start our discussion by defining fair use. What is it and how does it apply to copyright claims?
Sure. So our presenter at the ISMTE meeting was John Tandler, and he's a local copyright lawyer in Denver. And to explain fair use, he first pointed out to us that the First Amendment and the copyright law are somewhat at odds with each other. One prevents the government from abridging free speech, and the other makes it illegal to reproduce someone else's work, which does, in a small but not insignificant way, limit that freedom of speech granted by the First Amendment. Fair use, then, is basically the compromise that helps make it possible for those two legal concepts to coexist. It allows the use of someone else's ideas to further your own. If anyone were to accuse a publisher or an individual of copyright infringement, as long as the work in question were to pass the four-factor fair use test, the defendant would not be liable.
Okay, so I think you started getting into this, but talking more about fair use, what's the difference between attribution and fair use?
In a nutshell, fair use is an effective defense in a copyright suit, and attribution is not. A lot of people are probably under the misconception that if they use someone else's work, as long as they put it all in quotation marks and cite the original source, they're protected. I have to admit, even I was somewhat under that impression, but I learned that's not at all the case. If you're facing a copyright infringement lawsuit and your use of that quoted material at all detracts from the rights of the original creator, even if you use proper attribution, you could be on the hook for penalties. If you can demonstrate fair use, though, you may be in the clear.
So many college students are going to be in trouble.
I know.
So what types of works are kind of considered fair use under a copyright law?
The Copyright Act is explicit about a few examples. So criticisms, comments, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, research, all of those are covered under the concept of fair use. Not listed in the Act itself is parody, but that's another common use that has been proven to qualify many times. Mr. Tandler actually mentioned a couple of interesting court cases involving parody, one about a book that was published parodying Gone with the Wind called The Wind Done Gone, and another one that involved a rap group using the bass line from a Roy Orbison song, and parody creators won in both of those cases.
Interesting. So what are the four main factors in determining whether something is considered fair use?
Well, the court is first going to look at the purpose and the character of the use, including whether it's commercial or nonprofit. The most important question they'll be looking to answer here is whether the new work is sufficiently transformative. Transformative works are going to take what was borrowed from the original work and build upon that, so it ultimately serves a brand new purpose. Derivative works, on the other hand, serve the same or a very similar purpose as the original work, and they don't really add much value to the material. This is a really important distinction because the more transformative a work is, the more clear-cut the case is going to be, and the less weight is going to be given to the rest of the factors. Once the purpose of the work is established, the second factor is the nature of the copyrighted work. Interestingly, creative works are afforded more copyright protection under the law, and more factually based works are afforded less protection. So in the scholarly publishing world, which is where we do most of our work, this factor would be pretty easily satisfied. The third factor is the amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole. And the most obvious consideration is going to be how much material was taken, but that's not the only consideration or even necessarily the most important. Mr. Tandler gave us an example of a case where a magazine published excerpts from an unpublished upcoming book by President Ford, and they claimed it was fair use. And relative to the rest of the book, the magazine didn't print very much, but the quotes they used talked about Ford's decision to pardon Nixon, which was what everyone was most interested in reading about. So the court ended up deciding that even though the portion was small, it was essentially the heart of the work that was taken, and so they ruled in favor of the publisher. And then the last factor that the court's going to consider is the effect of use upon the potential market for the copyrighted work. Obviously, if the demand for the copyrighted work is diminished by the new work, fair use cannot apply. And what's a little less obvious is the fact that this is true for derivative works as well. So the rights protected under copyright law include the right of the author to prepare derivative works like translations or adaptations. And even if the creator hasn't exercised that right yet, if a new work diminishes the demand for a potential derivative work that might one day exist, it's not fair use.
All right, so let's switch gears a little bit to something that all authors and publishers deal with and that gives a lot of us here headaches, journal publishing agreements. So just in sort of a broad way, are there any sort of set guidelines that for the publishing agreements by journal?
Not at the moment, no. Because there are so many different types of publishers, there isn't really a one-size-fits-all approach or a set of rules. And in fact, a solid publishing agreement is going to take the needs and interests of the individual publisher into account. So large publishers are probably going to have different requirements than independent publishers or international publishers. So their agreements should really reflect those differences.
What about, are there some differences that you can name between journal publishing agreements for scholarly journals and trade journals?
Yes. So Mr. Tandler's specialty was actually trade publishing agreements. So he went into a little bit about the differences between the two models. Perhaps the biggest difference is that trade publishing agreements allow the author to retain the underlying copyright to his or her work, and they transfer only the rights to publish, sell, and license rights to the work. In journal publishing, traditionally, the underlying copyright transfers to the publisher. This isn't true across the board in cases for works for hire or works by government employees or works published by open access journals that use Creative Commons licenses. That transfer doesn't take place, but generally with traditional journal publishing models, copyright will belong to the publisher. And another difference is that in trade publishing, the author's granting rights to the publisher in exchange for royalties based on the commercial success. And again, traditionally in journal publishing, not always, but in most cases, no money is changing hands. The author's granting rights to the publisher basically for publication only. And of course, both trade and journal publishing agreements can identify additional rights that the authors retain. But in journal publishing, those additional rights are usually, at a minimum, the right to post the work on an institution's website or to share it with colleagues. So as for why those differences exist, there isn't really one definitive answer. Mr. Tandler's hypothesis was that it has something to do with how the Copyright Act treats collective works. Basically, the act lays out that the copyright for a collective work, which in this case is the journal, is separate and distinct from the copyright for an individual contribution to that work, which is the submitted article. So if the journal publisher allowed the author to retain the copyright for the individual work, they'd be really limited on how they could use that article. It would have to be in that particular volume or a revision of that volume, or maybe in another volume in the same series. But if they require the full bundle of rights, they're going to be free to use that article however they want in whatever medium at any time. And another possibility that Mr. Tandler mentioned was that publishers are better equipped than individual authors to handle copyright issues that might come up after publication, like requests for permission to reuse the material. So the publisher's resources in that domain would be particularly helpful where issues of international copyright law come in. And by absorbing the author's rights, publishers are actually affording the work more copyright protection against unauthorized use and somewhat streamlining the process for other authors who want to reproduce part of that work. And that's going to foster a generally more collaborative environment for research.
So going along those lines, for a new journal or, you know, a journal that's just kind of getting their feet wet right now, what are some guidelines that are maybe suggested for developing your own publishing agreement?
Some of the general advice that we got for establishing a new agreement or even just to reevaluate an old one was to bring in a diverse team. Our speaker recommended seeking input from not just legal experts, but also people who are intimately familiar with the author experience and with the publishing process and experts on the commercial side of things. That way you end up with a really well-rounded document. He also pointed out that it doesn't have to be overly legalistic, but it should be detailed enough that someone accustomed to working with legal documentation has their expectations met. And order is also really important. You wouldn't want, for example, to introduce the parties to a contract in the middle of the contract, so you want to make sure that it has a logical flow. And if possible, go into detail about the editorial process and the manuscript submission process so that the author knows what to expect from the experience. And finally, the agreement should also outline what's expected of the publisher as well as what's expected of the author. It wouldn't be fair to ask an author to sign away the rights to their article if it wasn't then also required that the publisher actually publish it. So a well-designed agreement should hold all parties responsible for their roles in the process.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ashley, for kind of giving us a bit of a crash course there on copyrights
yes,
and publishing
you.
Agreements. I'll never quite write a research paper the same way again.
Yeah, it was good to know all of that stuff. Thank you.
Yes.
Well, that is our Technicast today. For more information, you can visit our blog and the ISMTE website for more information about future meetings for them. Thanks and have a great day.